Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit DartmouthHitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. UNH is celebrating a huge birthday this year, 150 years since its founding in 1866. As President Mark Huddleston put it in his State of the University speech, UNH was educating students before the Wright brothers took flight, before the telephone was invented, before the Statue of Liberty raised her arm. In the address, Huddleston took great pride in this milestone, noting the university's past accomplishments and that a recent Gallup survey of UNH graduates shows they are largely doing well, engaged at work and in their communities. But Huddleston also presented the challenges facing UNH and higher education in general, bemoaning what he called the sterile and senseless debate about the purpose of college, whether it's about getting a job or learning for life. He said we should embrace both with vigor. Today in The Exchange, UNH President Mark Huddleston is here on where the state's flagship institution is today and what direction he's hoping to steer it amid a turbulent higher education landscape. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. It's your chance to talk with UNH President Mark Huddleston, so join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And President Huddleston, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good morning, Laura.
Well, let's talk about that senseless debate, to use your words, about the purpose of higher education. What does it sound like, President Huddleston, to you these days? What are you hearing?
Well, I hear a lot of people, especially those who are not immediately involved in the enterprise, talk about how we should be focusing more on making sure that kids get jobs and stop doing silly things like having them read history or English or those kinds of subjects. And that's what led me to characterize it as kind of a silly debate. Obviously, in my view, obviously, our students need both. They need to be equipped with the skills that they have to have to succeed in a highly competitive landscape out there. But at the same time, they need to be equipped as well for a lifetime of reflection and understanding how they fit into the world and to be the fully creative beings that we need them to be.
You said you hear that mostly from people outside the enterprise. You mean not students or parents or people involved in higher education, sort of people in the broader society?
Well,
or
maybe a ring or two outside. Certainly parents are very concerned.
They want their kids to have jobs.
Have jobs, absolutely. Get out of the basement, please. and I understand that fully, and I think that we in higher education have a responsibility to make sure they have those skills. As I think I said in that speech, it is simply wrong to have a student leave us with the same level of preparation that he or she joined us. I mean, we need to add some value, it seems to me, on that metric of being prepared for the workplace. But by the same token, that's not to say that we throw everything else overboard. We can do both. And we I think, do both very effectively at the University of New Hampshire.
So what do you hear from students, President Huddleston? I'm imagining someone coming in and saying, you know, I want to be a philosophy major, but my mom and dad say, no, I need to get a job. So here I am at the business school. I mean, what would you say to that student?
Well, first, I love philosophy majors. My oldest son is a philosophy major. He's doing very well. Thank you very much. My daughter was an English major, and she's doing very well. Thank you very much. So I can speak knowledgeably and personally about how a preparation in the liberal arts can lead to a very successful set of outcomes after college. By the same token, I can equally embrace the value of the kind of business education that we provide or the value of an engineering education. But as our students go through any of those tracks, they need to have some exposure to and facility with the kinds of opportunities that are available in those other tracks. None of our engineering students ought to leave us without having taken courses in literature or in philosophy. Equally, our students in philosophy and English need to leave with some practical skills that will actually help them get a job when they get out.
Are those skills required? I mean, you used the example in your speech of you said a nurse or an engineer or an accountant should not be denied the opportunity to stretch and grow and confront life's great question in a class on pre-Socratic philosophy or a seminar on Shakespeare. Is that nurse required to take some of those outside type courses, or is it just a suggestion?
No, I think there are some requirements built in, although I've got relative little faith in constructing elaborate sets of requirements and somehow think that's going to solve all of our problems. I think that it's better to operate in the realm of suggestions and advice and the kind of mentoring relationships that we try to have develop at UNH so that faculty members and others are constantly engaged with our students and make suggestions that are helpful at various points in their career. After all my decades in higher ed, I've learned that simply setting up long lists of requirements tend to produce checkboxes, but it doesn't always get to the heart of what needs to be done.
Give us a little bit more there, and I think I have a sense of what you're saying. I remember being in college and going, "Wait, I don't want to take statistics."
Well, sure,
yeah.
I gen ed is a good example, it seems to me, or general education for those who aren't au fait with the language. But almost all colleges and universities have sets of so-called general education requirements that seek to accomplish much of what we've been talking about, so that the philosophy major gets some taste of science or the science major gets some taste of the humanities. And the way that is fulfilled typically is by making sure that said student takes a course in another area, and you literally check a box, at least you used to when we had paper and pencils to do these things. And somehow that meant that the student had learned enough science or learned enough in the humanities, and they could go on their merry way, and we could satisfy ourselves that we had met that.
That they could at least function minimally in that area,
right,
if confronted with some of that information.
Right. But that's where we got to see the development of what we call like rocks for jocks or physics for poets or courses that were designed simply to, in my view, oftentimes game the system and just provide an opportunity for students to check that box rather than give them always a meaningful opportunity to engage with what those disciplines were really about.
What if that proverbial nurse, President Huddleston, wanted to take the Shakespeare class, but she looked at the cost of a college credit and she said, you know, that sounds interesting, but forget it. It's too expensive.
Well, we don't.
Can she really afford to engage?
We don't price things that way. I mean, the way you pay to go to college typically is you pay for a semester of courses and you fill out your course hours based on what you want to do after you've already paid that one bill for.
I see. So it's not credit by credit.
No, it's not. Community colleges, I think, operate that way, but we don't.
Our phone number for you to join us here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. This hour, we're sitting down with Mark Huddleston, president of the University of New Hampshire. By the way, elected the university's 19th president in 2007. So coming up on a decade on the job. 1-800-892-6477. Again, is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, one more question about this sort of embracing both with vigor. It isn't just about getting the skills you need for a job. It isn't just about sort of satisfying your intellectual curiosity. It seems, President Huddleston, that a lot of the money these days does seem to be going more towards STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. So how do you at UNH embrace both with vigor, to use your words, when the grants and the money and the pressure seems to be coming from that more technical side?
Well, I don't really feel it in those terms. It's always been the case that our federal funds, our extramural funds that go to underwrite research, are in the STEM areas because that's what federal funds have always done. They've gone to underwrite biomedical research. They've gone to underwrite work in geology or chemistry or physics and so forth. And so there's really not been any shift there. It's not as if in the 1980s there were huge mega grants in the area of philosophy or English, and now they've started to shift those into space science. That's not been a change. And the state has provided funding always in just a lump form for the university system and has not sought to try to shape the curriculum in the colleges and universities. I've really seen a shift more in students themselves and what they've been choosing to.
I was wondering about that. Yeah, it's kind of a chicken and egg question. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it really is the case that that majors are up in business and in engineering and sciences, and they're down in a lot of the liberal arts, and that tracks the concern that students have about getting jobs when they leave. And, you know, those data, too, can be confusing and hard to pick apart. It's absolutely true. It's inarguable that it's easier to get a job when you leave the university if you have a degree in accounting or you have a degree in mechanical engineering or in biological sciences than it is to get that first job if you have a degree in English or in philosophy. And it's equally, I think, inarguable that you'll be paid more immediately if you get that accounting degree or the mechanical engineering degree. But and this is what I meant when I said the data are hard to pick apart sometimes on this subject. If you look out 10 or 15 or 20 years, a lot of those differences tend to fade, and it's not always predictable that it's the accounting major rather than the English major who 20 or 30 years down the road is not going to be in the C-suite or otherwise making, you know, a lot of money or having a satisfying career. I would note that, for instance, this was pretty widely reported that the new North American commander of the U.S. military, Laurie Robinson, who was a 1981 graduate of the University of New Hampshire, in charge of all of the military side of Homeland Security, is an English major from the University of New Hampshire. Yep. She was an English major, an ROTC cadet and an English major.
Still, the student choices you're saying are, you know, don't blame UNH for that. The students are making the choices to pick these types of degrees. And so we are responding to that pressure. From 2005 to 2012, for example, there was a decline in liberal arts faculty from 240 to 213. That's just a result of student choices then.
Yeah, student choices, market pressures. It's certain, you know, we are a public institution and we have a responsibility in some part to respond to the workforce needs of the state. We take that very seriously, as do the other institutions in the university system, and certainly the community colleges do as well. And we know from our regular engagement with the business community, they're desperate for people with those skills. And again, it's not an either or. They appreciate, I find, the folks in the business community appreciate as much as I do communications skills, writing and oral communication.
So-called soft skills, soft which we hear skills. More and more
right.
businesses want.
Right. And you get a lot of that in the liberal arts. But by the same token, they do need more engineers. It's widely cited statistic is there's a deficit of about 1,000 software engineers in the state of New Hampshire alone.
Wow.
Dean Kamen will tell you, if you ask him, that he will hire every mechanical engineer that we produce. We just simply can't produce enough currently to meet the demand. So that again, it's a market force that's driving this interest, I think, in the STEM disciplines.
Why can't you produce enough to meet the demand?
Thank you for asking that question. We can't produce enough.
I mean, who wouldn't want to work for Dean Kamen if you were a mechanical engineer, right?
Because every one of our labs is maxed out. We literally do not have any more capacity to produce engineers and other students in the core STEM disciplines. Our labs are operating every day. Our faculty are fully engaged with as many students as they can possibly handle. And we were able to address a lot of the capacity problem thanks to the generosity of the state of New Hampshire in the earlier part of this new century, when we got capital investments from the state to redo Kingsbury Hall and Demerit and James and Parsons Hall, which allowed us to really to increase massively the number of engineers and chemists and other scientists that we were able to produce. Now the challenge is really to go beyond that and to meet the new demands in those fields, but also in biological sciences. We've done no renovation of those facilities. So we have companies like Lonza, major employer in the state of New Hampshire, that simply cannot fill the chairs that they've got to fill in order to keep up with their own business needs. And so we're going back to the state in this next session of the legislature and asking that they make a similar kind of investment in the biological sciences so that we can meet that workforce demand as well.
And that's a capital budget. That means buildings, not the usual state grant, which we'll talk about that in a minute. And also, you know, your thoughts and concerns about the high cost of college and the high level of student indebtedness here in New Hampshire. But let's go to our listeners, President Huddleston. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at some of the issues around what's happening at UNH and in higher education in general. 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Mark Huddleston, president of the University of New Hampshire. And let's go first to Catherine in West Lebanon. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead. You're on the air with Mark Huddleston.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am a mother of triplets. I have three in college right now.
Wow.
Two are liberal arts majors. One is an engineer, and they're all juniors. They're going to be graduating next year. Only my engineer has a full-time job promise after college. And in the 30 years since I got my degree, I see his course load as so much more rigorous. I mean, by, you know, an exponent of three, not three times harder, but he has so much coursework, and it's very unpopular, but I'd say his liberal arts courses get in the way. They're GPA killers, and he doesn't have time to really absorb the wonderful material of American philosophy and, you know, the great works that are presented before him. He'd need practically another year of school to really put the right amount of work into the liberal arts classes that are required.
So, Catherine, let me just make sure I got your story right. So you're mother of triplets, and congratulations on that. And they're all at UNH?
No, they're not. They're at different schools. The engineer is at state school in Texas.
Okay. And and he's saying, you know, I'm overwhelmed with just my engineering curriculum, never mind all this, you know, philosophy stuff.
Exactly. Yes.
So is your argument he shouldn't do that? Is that how you're feeling?
No. Or? Yes, I do have to say that I feel like it's, you know, I'm going to say this in quotations, a bad use of his time is to take these liberal arts classes. Believe me, it kills me to say that. But when I see the demands placed on undergraduate engineers, I don't know how they do it in the first place. And then to put liberal arts classes on top of that, that are important and works that deserve a lot of thought, I don't see that he's really getting anything out of it.
Well, Catherine, again, thank you so much for the call. It's so interesting to hear from somebody who has three kids in college, all the same age at the same time. President Huddleston, you said a couple minutes ago you personally don't believe in saying to the engineering major, you must take, you know, philosophy 101.
No, but when I hear those kind of comments, and I understand them, and I interact with a lot of engineering students, and even worse than that, by the way, are music majors. They work even harder. Music ed majors. They're in more required classes and spend more time studying and playing than anybody I know. But in any event, my response to that kind of comment always is two words: Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs. And if he were around now, he would say that in addition to understanding electrical engineering, you've got to have that spark of creativity that allows you to marry the science and the engineering on the one hand with what the world wants and needs. And that doesn't come necessarily from courses in electrical engineering.
Human interest and human creativity. Wasn't there some story about him taking a calligraphy class that he found very inspiring?
Exactly right, when he was at Reed College.
Yep. So you would say to our caller, Catherine, maybe your child should stick with those philosophy courses, even if they're painful.
I would encourage him to do that, or her to do that.
Okay. Catherine, thank you so much for calling in. We'll take more of your calls in a moment, and we will turn our attention to the rising costs of college here in New Hampshire and around the country. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with UNH President Mark Huddleston, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. We're looking at some of the themes that President Huddleston raised in his recent State of the University address. Here's one theme. President Huddleston cited excellence in research, teaching, and outreach as the first priority for his university, which he said sounds obvious, but is a tough sell in today's cost-conscious environment.
But there is tremendous pressure today in higher education to weaken standards, to compromise on quality, and to commodify our work in an effort to keep prices as low as possible. In one sense, that's understandable. College is expensive. Parents and students are burdened with debt. They aren't at all sure what they're getting for their money. They're angry. But the answer is not to walk away from our mission, join the race to the bottom, and mass produce shoddy goods.
Again, that's President Mark Huddleston in his recent State of the University address. And President Huddleston, what does that mean, a shoddy education? What does that look like?
Well, what it would mean to me is an education that was sort of stamped out in a mass production fashion, where the emphasis was on simply producing degrees, credentialing students, without really, in a very thoughtful manner, making sure they had actually learned anything or had become educated men and women. There's a big difference, it seems to me, simply between getting a diploma on the one hand, getting a credential, that is, and actually being an educated person. And I worry, actually, that a lot of the national emphasis on degree completion and on hitting relatively what might be relatively artificial targets of getting people college degrees is pushing us in the direction of commodification, worrying less about what students are actually learning and paying just more attention than we should simply to the credential, if that makes sense.
So let's get it all done in 3 years.
Get it all done in 3 years, or again, just make sure that the assembly line continues to run. It's like, you know, Lucy with the cupcakes, and things are spitting off the end. And I just think that would be a travesty for a system of higher education that is still the envy of the world. And we do have to get our arms around the cost issue and the burden on families. But let's not do that by just making it a less valuable product.
Well, and it is tough, though. College is very expensive. So, I mean, is that the choice? Expensive college, lots of debt versus commodified shoddy education? I mean, where's the middle ground there?
I hope that's not the choice. I think that the path that we've been on is unsustainable. I don't think that it is possible to continue both to have a very high-cost education and a high-quality model and just infinitely go out with the curves that we've seen because it is proving to be unaffordable for the average middle-class family. So something has to give. So what has to give? I don't think there's a magic bullet, any one single thing either. I think it'll be a complicated set of solutions. But I've said over and over again that I think that we need to think very carefully about who benefits from higher education and not put all of the burden of paying for higher education on the student and the family, because it really is it's a public good as well as a private good. And given the burdens on the states in recent years, there has been a disinvestment from higher education that seemingly has had us walk away from that recognition of the public good nature of higher education.
We think if you want to go to college, you reap the benefits,
be
so
right.
It's all on you and your family.
But that's simply not true. You certainly do reap benefits, but so does society. How much poorer would we be as a society if everyone individually chose not to go to college? It would be not a very vibrant or economically healthy place to live if everyone made that choice as individuals. We'd all be poorer for it. I think that we in the 21st century have reached the point as we did in the 19th century, where we need to raise the level of education that we come to expect as the standard for everyone. 100 years ago was high school, and now it's college, and that we need to embrace as a society the responsibility for making sure that everyone has the chance to do that, to get a college education.
I've got a lot more questions about the cost issue, President Huddleston, but lots of listeners who also want to jump into our conversation. So let's go back to them. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
First of all, good morning, and I want to make 18 comments, so I'll get them fast.
One, 18? No, Steve, that's too many.
Okay. First one is congratulations on 150 years. You sound like you know what you're doing. Good. Number two, I love the fact that you made the analogy to Lucy, because my students would not understand what you're talking about, but I do, for my love, Lucy.
Comedian Lucille Ball with the candies and the chocolates coming down the line super fast, and she can't stuff them all in her mouth at the same time. Yeah.
Right, okay. So when you talk about not learning, what have you? I'm sure you've heard the term Teflon education.
Teflon education,
means,
okay.
Which means from the Ronald Reagan days and Teflon. By the way, my students do not know what Teflon is. that nothing sticks. Exactly what the professor he said, that they want the degree, they want the diploma, but they do not want to learn. Number three is that I think that one of the problems I see is that many of my students now work full-time as well as college full-time, and that's a very hard road to hoe because something's got to give, and unfortunately the job often takes over precedent over the...
And Steve, if I could interrupt you, where do you teach?
I teach at Daniel Webster, Nashua, New Hampshire. Great school.
Okay. All right. So lots of thoughts there from our caller, Steve. One is sort of balancing work and life and so forth. I'm wondering, is that the case with UNH students, or are they more there for that four-year experience?
That's a great point that Steve was making. I think we often, when we talk about higher education in America, forget how diverse the student population is. And I think the mass media in particular tends to take Harvard and Yale as the representative example of all of higher ed and somehow think that that's the right set of examples to use to play out all these challenges and possible solutions. And that's just not true. At UNH, we have a lot of our students that are working a job or two jobs, sometimes three jobs, to try to get through school. But we're not at the far end of that spectrum. There's certainly a lot of students in America that are going part-time, and they may take a break from one semester to another as they try to save more money to get through school. And somewhere between that and UNH is a much more probably accurate picture of most college students in America. Most students don't apply to colleges that are selective at all, for instance. We could talk about that whole issue of admissions and selectivity.
We could do a whole show on college admissions, and we have done whole shows on it. What are your thoughts, President Huddleston, about online courses? That's one way that students working part-time who have to balance work and family and school, they sometimes access online courses. That's a way that some institutions are looking to save money and broaden their student base. I mean, what's the extent of online learning at UNH?
Relatively limited. I would say first, as a former faculty member, I am really, really glad that I stopped teaching before the online revolution hit. My wife is currently taking an online master's degree, and I just I marvel at A, at how much work she does, and B, even more at how much work her faculty members are doing teaching that online course. I don't think it's an easy road for either the student or the faculty member. That said, I do think that it provides a pathway for students and for faculty members to offer and to take courses that otherwise they wouldn't be able to do. That's certainly true for a lot of working adults who can time shift. They can engage in what we call asynchronous learning, when the lecture and other material may have been put up online a week or a month before, and they do it when they can. That's all to the good. I would hate to see us embrace a world where online learning replaced face-to-face learning. I just don't think it's a full substitute. I think there are areas where It can be a nice supplement, but it certainly isn't a replacement for face-to-face learning.
So when you said earlier something has to give in terms of the cost of college, that's not something that
I think that it'll be a multifaceted solution. And I think online might be part of that solution, but it certainly isn't the full solution.
Well, Steve, thank you for your call. Let's go to Josh in Plymouth next. Hi, Josh. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange with Mark Huddleston.
Hey, good morning. I was just wondering if Mark could comment on, I kind of see that the cost of college reflects all the extras, like the amenities. And I know it's kind of a competition to attract students, but, indoor track, fancy dining halls, things like that, when maybe, other countries kind of just focus on the education, getting the students to learn, not having all the extras.
So you think that might be driving up the cost as well, Josh, fancy amenities?
Yeah, I would like to hear Mark.
Sure, Josh, thank you for the call. And this comes up a lot, why are we building this new building or that new building or, gourmet food in the dining halls and, we all ate oatmeal and we were fine. I mean, that's the line that you hear.
Right, and walked uphill both going to and coming from school. And Josh, you makes a good point, although I think it's overblown. I think there are examples nationally of colleges and universities that have made investments in amenities that are clearly over the top, I think are over the top. That is not a charge that one could level at UNH or most of the other public universities I know with any degree of accuracy. We have indoor dining halls, but...
winter lasts a long time here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, we really don't have luxurious facilities by most measures, I think. We did renovate our football stadium, and people beat us up for that. Was that a waste of money? I don't think so. It's a facility that will serve the entire state of New Hampshire. It is a facility that will be nice, but certainly nothing like the kinds of facilities that people point their finger at and say are over the top elsewhere. It's a New Hampshire scaled facility. It's just kind of it's nice, workmanlike. Low cost and entirely funded by private dollars.
So that was funded with private dollars.
Absolutely.
You did take a lot of hit about that, and we talked about that last time you were on. I guess the question stemming from that whole thing, given that it was from private dollars, is not why did the university spend the money, because you didn't,
right.
But are you making as vigorous an effort in other areas that some people would feel are more important? I remember the last time you were on, people called in and said, look, I don't even go to these events. Why should I care that you invested your energy in getting the funding for that versus the arts facility, for example?
Well, as anybody who knows me or has listened to me for the last 9 years knows, I have spent more time and energy talking about arts facilities and the need for student scholarships than anything else. And I will continue to do that for as long as I'm around the University of New Hampshire. I agree. Those are ultimately much higher priorities. But, you have to find people who are writing the checks who are as interested in these things as you are. And what I have found is that the folks who are interested in writing checks for option A are not always interested in writing checks for option B. These are not fungible commodities for most would-be donors. And we've actually been very, very successful on raising money for student scholarships, for instance, and we put the first new building up on the University of New Hampshire campus for academic purposes, largely with private dollars. That's the Peter Paul College of Business. So we've got a lot of good stories to tell, too, about where our private philanthropy is.
And the Carsey
directed.
School of Public Policy is also a big grant.
It's entirely the result of Marcy Carsey's generosity. That's right. Yep.
Let's take another call. And thank you for that one, Josh. And Will is calling from Southern Maine. Hi, Will. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I am on campus now, walking over to Petty Hall. I'm one of your lecturers, President. And first thing I wanted to say is can't say enough about what an amazing experience it is to work here on campus. I love my job, and can't say enough about that. I was wondering if the president could talk broadly about just kind of workforce issues within the university, We have tenure-track faculty, lecturers, adjuncts, and I'd just be curious about the president's kind of long-term view of the issues around kind of university workforce.
Well, and Will, are you happy to remain a lecturer or an adjunct, or would you like that, you know, classic full-time tenure-track position?
Well, the lecturer is a very kind of honorable position here, where in a way, some of the in numbers, we do a lot of the kind of day-to-day running of departments, teaching, and it's a great job. So I'm very happy with my position, and tenure track certainly an option for me. But for the moment, it's a great role to be.
Okay, well, Will, thank you very much for calling in. And as you know, President Huddleston, many universities, including UNH, have tried to save money through greater use of adjuncts. Over the last decade, UNH part-time instructional faculty has increased by more than a third, while full-time faculty has gone down by about 10%. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on Will's question, the choice to use adjuncts over full-time faculty.
Sure. Well, first, thank you, Will, for the question and for your good work at UNH. We have tremendous respect for our lecturers. They do carry an important part of the instructional mission at UNH, and we couldn't do it without you. One way to think about the question is, if you were given a blank sheet of paper and you could design any kind of university workforce you wanted, what would it look like? Would you hire nothing but tenure-track professors if money weren't an issue? And my answer to that would be no. I think that we want at an institution like the University of New Hampshire, we want a blend of different instructional folks. We want people who are devoted entirely to teaching because that's what they're passionate about and that's where they want to put their time and energy, which is what our full-time lecturers do. We want people, because we are a flagship research institution, we want people who have got that research expertise and passion in their own tool bag, and that's what our tenure track faculty do. They're expected to combine both the research and the teaching and outreach missions of the university. We also need people, by the way, who are purely research faculty, and we have a fair number of those at UNH, folks who are largely supported on grants and contracts, and that's where they put their time and energy. We also need people who are not full-time at the university. We need some adjuncts, given the mission that we have. If your son or daughter were in our business school, for instance, I suspect that he or she would feel much poorer if they didn't have the opportunity to hear directly from people who have taken a couple of hours a week off from their job in a New Hampshire or Boston-based corporation to come in, lecture and instruct them on what's happening right now in the world of business in that particular area. So I could go on, or clinical faculty in our Health and Human Services College.
How do you feel, President Huddleston, about the general criticism, though, that not just at UNH, but in higher education overall, that the balance is out of whack? Too many adjuncts, not enough full-time.
I do think that's a fair criticism. If one looks at higher education in general, I don't think it's a fair criticism of UNH, but in general it is true, I think, of higher ed. And it has partly been driven by costs. It's also it's a problem we need to think about because of the impact on adjuncts. There really are sad cases of people essentially living in their cars trying to stitch together lives by teaching at multiple universities for really poor compensation.
All right. Lots more to dig into in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, UNH President Mark Huddleston is with us on issues affecting UNH itself and higher education in general. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And President Huddleston, one more question about lecturers or adjuncts that we were talking about just before the break. You mentioned earlier a Gallup survey of UNH grads showed UNH graduates thriving, doing pretty well, engaged in work and community. One thing that these UNH graduates who responded to the survey said, it was very important to their college experience overall and their success later in life to have a strong relationship with at least one professor who really cared. And when you think about it, it makes sense. How does the increased use of adjuncts at UNH, again, over the past decade, increasing by more than a third, how does that affect those relationships that are apparently so important for students to feel like, yeah, this was good, a good experience for me?
Oh, I'd be very worried about it if I thought we really had added too many adjuncts. The data that I've seen suggests that in the last 4 or 5 years at least, the number has gone down. But again, I'd be careful about painting with too broad a brush. We have some adjuncts who are superb. In fact, I don't think we have very many faculty who aren't superb, but I wouldn't use adjuncts and tenure track as somehow code words for qualified and not qualified. The people that we hire as adjuncts are people that we select for reasons not to do with instructional cost, but because they add something to the student's educational experience. That said, as we were talking before you went to your break, I do think nationally there are institutions that, for a variety of reasons, mostly for cost pressure, have decided to go the route of cutting down the number of their tenure track faculty, hiring a bunch of adjuncts, and trying to sort of pull an educational fast one. And that is a compromise of the student experience. But that hasn't happened at UNH.
And my comment about adjuncts wasn't so much on their quality, because I'm sure there are some terrific adjuncts. It's more that if someone is only on campus to teach,
sure,
you know, one class or two class,
yep,
he or she can't,
yep,
invest in those relationships that students value.
Agreed. But whether the number at UNH has gone up a bit or down a bit, and whatever period of time you want to use to look at the statistics, the fact is that tenure track faculty are still the heart of our instructional mission at UNH. Every UNH student has an opportunity to develop those kinds of relationships with a tenure track faculty member.
Well, a bunch of emails I want to share with you, President Huddleston. Again, you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Armando, who says he's a student at UNH. He says, in the 2015 fiscal year, President Huddleston made $502,000, a $395,000 salary, $107,000 bonus. Where does that money come from? Is there any connection between that money and the money which I, as a UNH student, pay? And Armando, thank you for the email. This did come up in your town hall, mm-hmm, with students, President Huddleston. Students said, hey, you know, you're making a lot of money. Other administrators are making a lot of money. What about us?
Sure. Well, let's talk. I can talk specifically about my salary if you want to, but just more generally first about salaries at UNH. Whether we're discussing faculty salaries or professional staff salaries or top administrator salaries, we try to use the same principle with everyone, which is to pay market rates. We try to be fair with everyone, which is why we look to the market. We also try to be fair to ourselves by looking at the market, because if we don't pay market rates, we cannot recruit and retain the talent that we need to meet our various missions. So that's the general principle. Second thing I'd say about that is that for many folks, we've been seeking to move to a performance-based pay system, which means that you get a certain portion of your pay kind of as a given in any year, but then there's another portion of your pay that will be based entirely on how well you do or how poorly you perform in that year. And that first part of your pay, the part that you get anyway, is significantly less than the market rate. What we try to do is if you do really well and you add together that performance-based component and that initial component, then you're going to wind up at around the 50 or 60th percentile in the range of your market.
So doing right in the middle to your comparable colleagues
nationwide.
That's
always our aim, right? So when people see that people are paid bonuses at UNH or at other institutions in the university system, they should stop and take a deep breath and recognize that that bonus, in many cases, is only bringing people up to that midpoint of the market, and we're simply trying to incentivize harder work or more creativity or higher levels of performance in breaking out pay into those different components.
still, President Huddleston, it's a lot of money, and I wonder how that, just as a PR move, how that goes over with parents in New Hampshire who are struggling to write those tuition checks.
Sure.
These salaries are very high.
And I didn't finish answering Armando's question. The real answer to his question is that my pay and the pay of faculty members and of the folks that do our buildings and grounds all come from all of the various sources of our revenue. It gets put into a single pot, but that pot is filled by student tuition dollars. It's filled by state funds. It's filled by earnings from our endowment. It's so on. It's a variety of sources of revenue. And some of the salaries look high compared to other salaries in the state, but we have a need for talent that is not necessarily commonplace. We have people who are experts in their field, and we are competing in an international market to try to land them and keep them at UNH. So the appropriate point of comparison is not to what the average salary in New Hampshire is. The appropriate point of comparison is what's the average salary in the field that the person works in. And I'd be shocked to have anyone find examples where UNH is overpaying for the talent that we have in the various marketplaces that we compete in. We don't.
Let's take some more emails and some more calls. And Wade is joining us from Hillsboro. Hi, Wade. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to comment on the money thing. We have lost the sense of education as a public good. You cannot have a democracy if you have masses of badly educated people. Democracies have not survived with masses of uneducated people. That's why our ancestors right after the Revolution set up a lot of little academies all over New England. If I were a billionaire, I wouldn't run for president, and I'd give the money to UNH.
Well, Wade, I'm sure President Huddleston loves your comments. Did you have a particular question that you wanted to ask him?
No, I guess I have a question for my fellow citizens, why they're not willing to spend more money to give more and more of our young people a well-rounded education.
Well, and actually, this gets into something I did want to ask you, President Huddleston. So thank you, Wade, for the call. You know, often when you come in and talk to us on The Exchange, it's during a budget year, President Huddleston. Just remind us what happened in the last budget cycle here in New Hampshire, and then we'll get your thoughts about the next time around.
Sure. In the last budget cycle, we got a modest increase in our operating funds. And in the capital side of the budget, we had asked for, I referenced this earlier, we had asked for $35 million to contribute to a $70-plus million project to build out our biological sciences facilities. And we got $5 million for the entire university system for all capital projects. So we were actually unable to do anything meaningful on the infrastructure side.
And again, that's the building side, the labs that you said are to capacity, and you would bring in more graduates or bring in more students for those high-tech jobs if you had the lab space.
Exactly. And with the increased, the modest increase in the operating dollars, we had a significant increase in the financial aid that we provided our students. And that's one of those other complexities that I would urge people to try to work through when they see these numbers, that when our tuition goes up, as it probably will this fall, by 2.5%, it doesn't mean that our New Hampshire residents are actually going to pay that additional money, because we put a significant amount of our operating dollars into financial aid. So in this next biennium, I'm very hopeful when we go back to the legislature that we'll get not only an increase again in our operating revenue so that we can provide more opportunities, as Wade referenced, for New Hampshire residents to come to college, but we'll be able to do it in facilities that will actually be helpful for the state's workforce by an increase in the capital appropriation as well.
Well, and it's a tough case to make before the legislature. You know, everybody wants a spoonful out of that big, you know, that big pot, whether it's for, you know, the red listed bridges that we hear about or efforts to improve child and family services and so forth. So just make the case for us, President Huddleston, for what you're going to ask for next time. And this idea, this sort of struggle over education as a public good in the face of all these other competing demands. An opioid crisis, for example, that's another huge focus of attention.
It is. And I would never want to argue that those other things aren't huge priorities for the state as well. Instead, what I would say, simply talking about higher education, is that the return on investment, I mean, forget about all of the loftier aims of the work that we do, but just look at it just strictly as an economic proposition for the people of the state of New Hampshire. For the very, very modest investment that the people of New Hampshire make in their public university system, which in the last biennium, I think for the entire system of Keene, Plymouth, University of New Hampshire, and Granite State was, I don't know, 70-some-odd million dollars. They get a return on that investment using conservative economic assumptions of close to $2 billion. I mean, it's nutty. I mean, if you could invest your own money with that kind of a return, you'd be racing to that investment opportunity. But that's just the economic return. Beyond that, as Wade points out, there are so many other benefits that flow to our community by having an educated citizenry, including the political benefits, social benefits, health benefits. I mean, just on and on down the line.
Harder to measure than a repaired bridge.
Harder to measure, but boy, you sure feel the effects just as much as an unrepaired bridge.
I have a lot of emails that I want to try and share with you, President Huddleston. And you just used the word return on investment. So this email from Vinny says, what are strategies, are resources you could suggest to students to aid them in finding balance between return on investment and following their passion? This gets to our earlier conversation about, you know, education, whether it's about finding a job or becoming an informed citizen or both. Specifically, Vinny says, prospective students who realize their passion may not have a significant market value. You mentioned your son, the philosophy major, earlier.
Yep.
So, Vinny, this is right up what we've been talking about. Thank you.
So what would be the advice to individual students?
Yeah, who are seeking that balance between following their passion and making a living. My nephew, for example, is a history major, mm-hmm. and he's 3.5 years in, and he's starting to panic a little bit.
Yep. Well, here's an example. We are developing what we call toolboxes for students who are of almost any major who can go to that toolbox and develop a competency in analytics, for instance, or in coding, for instance. You don't have to major in it. You don't have to minor in it. You can take a sequence of courses that will provide you, to use the jargon of the field now, with a stackable credential that will in turn mean that you can be a major in history, or you can be a major in Italian literature, but at the same time have a set of skills that will allow you immediately out the door to earn some money. And that may not be in the field of Italian literature, may not be in the field of history, but you can be pursuing your passion in college and you can be developing those soft skills and building toward a career in what you want to do. But at the same time, when you leave the university, you'll be able to go to a social media company and say, I can do some coding for you, or I can do some big data analytics for you because I've taken a sequence of courses at UNH and here's my credential.
And then are you letting down that all that work that you put into Italian literature? You're never using it again? You're setting it aside?
No, of course not. I mean, that's what we said earlier in the show, that those are experiences that you will have had in college that will serve you for the rest of your life. And they may not present themselves later in life as, well, I'm now a professor of Italian literature, but you will have developed an appreciation for another culture, for the role of language in human experience, and we would go on and on. But those aren't lost experiences by any means.
Well, a couple more emails on this same point. It's so interesting that folks are really tapping into this. Here's one from Lisa. And Lisa, I apologize, I won't read the whole thing, but she says she graduated from UNH in 1989 with a BA in political science, had less than let's see, $5,000 in student loans, was able to get a job, pay rent, own a car, etc. Now her son will be entering UNH as a freshman. My husband and I are looking at financing almost $30,000 per year. Given the debt burden that our students are graduating with, Lisa says it is not realistic to think that a liberal arts degree is going to be able to provide students with a career that is going to be able to allow them to live independently. Lisa says, I think students and their families need to look long and hard at what the return on their investment is going to be. I think you've pretty much addressed that, President Huddleston. Thank you, Lisa, for the call. Here's another, for the email. Here's another email from Jack. As a UNH liberal arts major myself, I was well prepared to adapt to the dynamic nature of today's economy. Some of my friends with more technically oriented degrees have struggled in the face of economic and technological shifts in the economy. That's those soft skills that can kind of apply anywhere. And here's one last one. This is from a professor. His name is Michael. He says, I am a Whittemore School of Business and Economics undergraduate, and I wanted to say the university has served me well. After graduating, I was inspired to go on to earn my Master's of Science in Business Education at SNHU. And I'm proud to say that they allowed me to become a full-time professor for the past 15 years. He says, my UNH professors from the 80s and 90s were instrumental in inspiring me and providing me with teaching opportunities. And I won't go on to read the rest of the email because we've run out of time, President Huddleston. But there you go, pro-UNH and pro-SNHU. And
a good place to conclude. And it's the hour has zipped by again, as always.
Well, we'll catch up with you maybe in 5 or 6 months and talk about some of these other issues.
While we're celebrating our 150th.
Now you're celebrating.
Sesquicentennial.
Happy 150th birthday.
Thank you.
All right.
Drive safely, everyone, today.
That's Mark Huddleston again, president of the University of New Hampshire, elected the university's 19th president in 2007. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Mikesell with help from Jessica Hunt. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.